Welcome to Haldane's Law Matters. Thank you. Today's guest is Sanjeev Aaron Williams. I'm going to ask you to explain your name in a minute, but let me introduce you firstly as a commercial lawyer who has worked in, among other places, Hong Kong with international firms and local firms, and moved with business studies to entrepreneurship and tech. And you've been vocal recently of geopolitical and digital economies. And you've become something of a social media warrior, I think, Sanjeev. And I want to delve into that and utilize it a little today. But before we do, I think I'm right in saying that I read you in Gavanku, which is a magazine.
It's one of Hong Kong's luxury magazines.
It's not known to me. I've not been chasing Hong Kong's luxury. But in any event, you were talking about gyms and the demise of the gym in Hong Kong to some extent. So can we just start off with health, and then I'm going to circle around into you explaining a little bit more about your background.
So the gyms in Hong Kong have been the subject of scandal and scam for the last 40 years, ever since the fitness craze started. And a lot of people, including myself, lost money on these big name gyms. And that was one of the reasons that I'm currently using the government gym, because that's not going to go broke anytime soon. They have a social responsibility to provide recreational facilities. So this thing about physical, which had been in business for 38 years, and God knows how many times I'd actually thought of joining them, but thank goodness I didn't. Going broke after 38 years, and then just before they did, they were grabbing clients and trying to rope them into long-term contracts, some going beyond 10 years. That was really quite unconscionable. So I had written stuff on LinkedIn about it, and the writers on the magazine came to me. They were doing a feature story about the collapse of physical and the sorry state of commercial gyms generally. And they asked me a bunch of questions about the state of gyms.
So it's something about your personality at the moment, isn't it? To be this warrior, would that be fair?
I wouldn't call myself a warrior. Somebody tried it and I got a little bit offended. I think what happened was I started expressing my views as a result of having lived in Vancouver for 10 years. And I was watching the news reports and the TV reports, and I was quite surprised at how inaccurate and distorted they were. And when I'd write to them and say, this is wrong, your reports about Hong Kong are incorrect, all I got was silence. I was completely stonewalled. And the more I looked at it, the angrier I became. And it explained a lot as to why people in the West were so uninformed about Asia generally, and in Hong Kong in particular. So when I returned to Hong Kong, I gave it a lot of thought. I discussed it with my mum and said, look, shall I do this? Because chances are I will get a ton of flack for it. And she said, either you're brave or you're a coward. And I chose not to be a coward. And I write about geopolitical risk, digital economy, Hong Kong, and law.
So before we look at that aspect of your life, and we shall, let's just go back in time to see what shaped these views. So were you born in Hong Kong?
No, my family by origin is North Indian, and I constantly get asked about my name. Where did the surname Williams come from? The first thing is I don't have any Western blood in me, according to my parents. My father's family is actually Muslim. At some point, there was a scandal. It appears that either my great-grandfather or somebody beyond him killed a family member, and under Muslim law had to be hunted down. Legend has it he fled and was given shelter by a bunch of American missionaries with the surname Williams and adopted that name to save his life. Now, that's the story my dad told me. I can't verify its authenticity. But given the way that geopolitical events have gone in the world, so long as my original surname is not Bin Laden or something like that, I'm fine with it.
You should get away with it. Yes. Yes. Tell us a little bit, if you will, about your childhood, how you grew up, the educational side of life.
My parents moved to Hong Kong in the early 1960s when I was a toddler, so I had no choice in the matter. My mother was given the final say. The choice was between Bangkok, Singapore, and Hong Kong. She loved Singapore, and so did I. According to my parents, I entertained myself endlessly by treating the hotel bidet as my personal water fountain. But at the time, this was before 1965, so Lee Kuan Yew had not yet come to power, and Singapore was unstable. They were facing communist threats. They were going to be kicked out of the Federation of Malaya. So my mother decided on Hong Kong, and that's where we settled. Colonial Hong Kong was, to me, quite wonderful. I grew up in the Kowloon Tong area. And let me give you the context of what Hong Kong looked like physically during that time. There was no Lion Rock Tunnel. There were no cross harbor tunnels. There was no flyovers. Harbor City didn't exist. Ocean Terminal did not exist. All this stuff where you have the Regent Hotel and the Rosewood Hotel, those were all docks and wharves. Tsim Sha Tsui East were beaches and military bases. And the whole infrastructure of Hong Kong had yet to take off. So if you came out, let's say, at Tsim Sha Tsui Star Ferry and you turned left, there was no Ocean Terminal. Ocean Terminal came online in 1966. And the reason I can tell you that with such definitive accuracy was because my primary school did a day trip the day after Ocean Terminal was officially opened by Princess Margaret. And the first ship to berth there was the Canberra.
I remember that.
Yeah. So before that, there was no Star House either. That whole area left of Star Ferry was nothing more than wooden piers, docks, jetties, sampans, barges. So now that you see Harbour City, the holding company is Wharf Properties Limited. That's where the name came from.
Yes, yes. So this is late 50s, early 60s?
Early 60s.
This is early 60s, yeah.
Yeah.
So Hong Kong, an entirely different place.
It was a lovely place. I mean, growing up in Kowloon Tong, a taxi to Star Ferry would cost you about $2.60 or $2.80. There were rickshaws in Tsim Sha Tsui and in Central. If I was a particularly good boy, my mother would allow me to ride in my own rickshaw in front of hers, and we would be taken as far as Pottinger Street, sometimes Sheung Wan, which was regarded as out in the sticks.
Yes.
Kowloon Tong, for me, was quite idyllic. I spent most of my time riding my little bike with the training wheels, dressed only in my underwear and my sandals. So my early childhood memories of Hong Kong are near total nudity and a great sense of urban safety.
Yes.
I never felt threatened, never felt harassed. I was just this little foreign kid riding his bike around Kowloon Tong, which incidentally was a very British area because it had a lot of military bases. Where Festival Walk is today, that was St. George's School and the playground and all of that. And near the Haralila Mansion, all of that was also British military. The earliest supermarkets set up in Kowloon Tong. In that area. And the Chinese armors at the time, they didn't know how to deal with it because they would go to the fresh markets. So as a kid, I would loiter outside the supermarket and they would come to me with their shopping list and the money and I would go in and
facilitate it,
buy it for them.
So in the early 60s, Lion Rock Tunnel still didn't exist. I can't remember when it was built.
Around about 1966, I think.
So how did one get into that?
Shut in?
Yeah.
You went up as far as the Baptist Hospital, turned right onto Junction Road, and then there was the Shut-In Pass Road, which got you around. And in those days, Shut-In was, again, out in the sticks, and the air was different. There were rice paddies, there were oyster beds. There was also a floating restaurant out in Shut-In.
Right.
So it was a completely different environment. The cars on the streets were all British cars, a lot of them. The taxis. Morris Austin's, yeah. Morris Minor's, Sunbeam's, Hillman's, Humber's, Triumph Herald's, Triumph Spitfire's, Jaguar's, the E-Type Jag. You'd see all of these British marks, the Rover, none of which exist today.
I was going to say, when did they start? It disappeared, I think, with the Mercedes coming in as the taxi. Is that right?
Yeah. At that time, you had the Austin Morris taxis and the Mercedes taxis. And then later on, the Japanese taxis started to appear.
Toyotas.
Yeah.
By the time I came in 1978, it was Toyota, I think.
Yeah.
I don't remember many Mercedes then.
One of the nice things about the taxi fleet in Hong Kong at that time was that it was possible to get the same taxi driver home because they would drop you off, let's say, in Tsim Sha Tsui from Kowloon Tong, and they would be driving along and they'd see you on Nathan Road and they'd stop and they'd honk their horn and they say, hello, do you want to go back home?
So what would the population have been about then? Do you remember?
About 3.5 million, because most of the population was living towards eastern Kowloon, Kwantong, Natal Kok, Tiwan Shan, Wak Tai Sin. That's because the government had built the phase one of the resettlement estates at that time to deal with the influx of people who were fleeing the communist revolution in China.
Yes.
In fact, that's how I started eating dim sum, because these guys would come with their carts and their bicycles with char siu pao and all of that. And the reason they were coming to Kowloon Tong, notwithstanding that it was a British area, an Indian area, a Portuguese area, was because the Chinese armors were living in the houses. They had maids' quarters. And then on weekends, they would go back to the resettlement estates. So these itinerant hawkers with their dim sum would come there and sell, and the Chinese armors would buy the shatin tofu, which was quite famous, and the char siu pao and the dim sum, and that's how I started eating Chinese food.
It's a very colorful time, not only colorful visually, but it had the aromas, all the cooking aromas.
Yeah.
And the
one other thing was that there were only two TV channels. Yep. It was Rediffusion Television. Channel 1 was Chinese, Channel 2 was English, and TV started at 5 p.m. and shut down again at 11 p.m.
Very civilized.
Very, very civilized.
All right. So now you went to university here?
I went to school here.
Yeah.
Kowloon Junior and King George V School. Very, very prestigious British education. And the education in those schools was absolutely first rate. Yeah. It was a privilege to go to these schools. Predominantly English kids. There were some Chinese kids and Indian kids. But they really drilled the education into you, particularly the English language. We were tested on composition, comprehension, grammar, spelling, précis, dictation, enunciation, poetry, prose. And you had to pass all those elements every year. So the kind of drilling that they gave us was quite brutal at times.
Intense, yeah.
Very intense.
But it worked.
It worked. I loved junior school. KG5 was interesting in its own way, but it was transactional to me because I realized I wanted to do law. And in order to do that, I had to learn a bunch of subjects in order to get a bunch of certain grades in order to go to university. So it was a somewhat more detached experience for me because I was there for a specific purpose.
And was it English Schools Foundation by then?
No, I left KG5 after A-levels 1 year before it became an ESF school.
I see.
At that time, it was a government school run by the education department.
And then university? Law degree?
Yes. People ask, why did I become a lawyer? And I can tell you, it wasn't altruism, and it certainly wasn't a quest for social justice. It was really curiosity and experimentation. What were my powers of persuasion? How could I pivot somebody to my point of view? That was the driving force behind it. For the longest time, my parents thought I'd be doing music because I was studying music as a child. And they went off to a parent teachers association junior career counseling. I was 13 or 14 at the time and playing piano, doing the music exams, all of that. I also had an addiction to the game of backgammon. And so my parents asked me, what do you intend to do when you leave school? And my answer was become a part-time piano player and professional gambler. And that's what they ended up telling the teachers. So when I look back on my life now, to some extent, that I'm still something of a professional gambler in the way things have developed. So university was in the UK at Warwick University.
And then you came back to Hong Kong?
Yes. Can I tell you a little story about that one?
Of course.
I caused a scandal in KG5. My first choice of university was actually King's College London. And I exceeded the grades that they had set me. But I got angry with them because they had set me the highest grades of 81 in that year. And I said, I'm going to show you. So I exceeded the grades, picked up the school prize for A-levels, and then promptly rejected King's College London. And that resulted in telegrams being sent by King saying, have you made a mistake? Is there something wrong? The school principal went apoplectic, called up my parents and said, what on earth is going on? We've never had this situation before. And I realized why I did it. King's was a very traditional university. And at my core, I'm not a traditionalist. So I decided to go for my third choice, which was Warwick University, which at the time was fairly new. It was only about 12 years old.
Yeah.
And the teachers were saying, why on earth are you swapping King's for a bloody polytechnic? And it wasn't. Now it's one of the top universities in the UK.
Yes.
When I got to Warwick the first day of law school registration, they said, ah, you're Sandeep Williams. I said, yes. And he said, just one question, dear. Why aren't you at King's?
Do you ever regret it, by the way? Making that stand?
No, because Warwick was a very modern university, very future-looking, gorgeous campus. And I just loved the environment.
Glad to hear it. So, let's just take you through this little aspect of life, because I know from being a commercial lawyer and successful, you actually took a break, and I think that was for family reasons. Would you perhaps give us a little idea of what was going on then in life?
Yes, two things. I took a break. I'd been considered for partnership, but I was also leaving Hong Kong at the time to move to Vancouver. And that was because I'd been studying business during my spare time. I'd been studying trends for many years as a junior lawyer, and I'd begun to see the importance of studying business and the importance of the internet. So I took a break and moved to Vancouver for a few years and created a commercial finance company to test myself. It was the equivalent of an outward bound course, basically. I didn't know anybody. I bought the house there, took the taxi from the airport. It was snowing, dumped my suitcases, went to shop, bought a snow shovel, started from there. So I did that, moved back to Hong Kong, and I'd been studying trends. And I was coming back to law, and that's when my mother was diagnosed with cancer. And she showed me the lump on her body, and I knew there and then those CVs were not going to go anywhere. In fact, it was very serious. It was advanced cancer. And the doctors had said to me that even if you were working, we would have told you to stop. It was a very hard 9 years. And here's why. There are basically four kinds of people with cancer. The first is those who get cancer and die within 5 minutes. Second, those who get cancer and recover in 5 minutes. The third is those who get cancer and linger in pain and discomfort for a number of years and then die. And the fourth are those who get cancer, linger, put up with the pain, but ultimately recover. And that's the category my mother fell in. So I had absolutely no control over the time frame. You've heard of the term emotional roller coaster. I had season tickets to ride on that thing.
Right.
I was told repeatedly she wasn't going to make it, but she did. And to be frank, it's one of my proudest achievements, getting her through it. In fact, for the longest time, I wouldn't come onto LinkedIn. I was so embarrassed by this gaping hole in my CV. I had to be persuaded by two young lawyers in Singapore, and they said, you get onto LinkedIn, we'll be your first two contacts.
So that was a very hard 9 years, and at the end of it, presumably you'd lost quite a few legal contacts.
I had lost a few legal contacts, one because of the cancer and two because I was out of Hong Kong. But since building my brand on LinkedIn, people are coming out of the woodwork now and wanting to know me, which is just fine because I'd like to come back to law reinvented.
Which is why you're on our podcast today. You're attracting attention. We'll come on to that.
Yes, go ahead.
So in any event, you'll be delighted to come back into Hong Kong law?
Yes, Hong Kong is really my home. Having lived in the UK as a student in the 70s, and I'm sure you'll recall the UK at that time was quite grim. And then living in Canada during the 90s, which was an eye-opening experience because I finally realized, dare I say it, the superiority of my culture as a North Indian. Because you have these thousands of years worth of culture compared to the relatively recent Western culture.
Yes, which neatly takes me on to Kishore Mahbubani, is that correct?
Yes, Kishore Mahbubani was the former Singapore ambassador to the United Nations. He's a well-known geopolitical commentator and author.
And what made me think of him then was your comment about the long history of India, which mirrors in length the long history of China.
It does. The two cultures are very similar. They're very deep. They're very rich cultures, and they've given the world so much. Unfortunately, when you go to the West, there is a certain degradation and cheapening of the Indian culture. Ah, it's a Friday night. Let's go get a curry takeaway. It's basically that and nothing else. But the culture is so rich. And perhaps I had to be away from Hong Kong and in a completely foreign environment in order to appreciate it. Even though growing up in Hong Kong, I was always a minority.
Yes. You've felt a minority through life?
Yes, it has its advantages and it has its disadvantages. Growing up in Hong Kong, this is going to be politically incorrect if you're going to allow me to say it.
Yeah, you could be as incorrect as you wish.
I would get the British parents of my schoolmates coming up to me and saying, you know, the only reason we allow our kids to play with you is because you speak good English. That was something of a backhanded compliment. You could not get away with that today.
No.
I'll tell you another story. I was 8 years old at the time, and my classmate Stephen was having a birthday party at the USRC on Gascoigne Road. And in addition to the birthday invitation, I had to have a note from his parents to allow me to go in to the USRC because non-whites, non-Chinese were not usually seen there. And so they looked at the invitation, they looked at this note, and they go, we don't usually get your kind in here. And I was the only brown kid swimming in the pool, and there were people pointing at me.
Yeah, he's got a good suntan.
So I was always a minority, but there were two things. On the one hand, you grow up slightly marginalized, and on the sidelines, you feel like an urban exile. But on the other hand, you also develop your powers of observation. And that, I think, held me in good stead decades later.
I mean, everywhere has got its degree of racism, but Hong Kong's pretty free of it by world standards. Would we agree?
Another funny story. Yes, absolutely, I would agree. When I moved to Vancouver, I was living in an allegedly affluent white neighborhood, and nobody came to my door with cookies. Instead, they asked whether I was looking after the house for the owner. And when I told them I was the owner, they never spoke to me again. I did make history because the neighborhood community center was quite prestigious, and I became the first ethnic minority director on their board and chair of the fitness committee at the same time. And by the time I left, they loved the work that I'd done for them because I revamped the whole fitness center.
Yeah.
And they were grooming me to become the vice president of that community center.
Was it a successful grooming? Did you get the post?
I was actually in the process of returning to Hong Kong at that time, so I turned it down.
All right. Good. Can I ask you this? I've been here since February 1978. That's 46 years. I've seen Hong Kong, as you have, change when it comes to questions of being marginal people. As an Englishman, I was a marginal person as well.
Yes, but at that
minority.
Time, you were also of a privileged class.
Yes, no, I get that all right. But what I was going to suggest is, that have we seen a marked improvement in terms of the acceptance of different races here over the years?
Yes, you have. Let's qualify that. I would never call Hong Kong a racist city.
No.
It is certainly very international. What has changed, and I think this is going to be permanent, is the influx of mainland Chinese, some of whom are well-educated, some of whom are not. So there is a resentment that I pick up as I walk the streets between the Hong Kong Cantonese and the mainland Chinese that are moving in. But I don't pick up any resentment towards the non-Chinese. And I think that is something we should be very proud of.
Yes, I'd agree with you. Can I come back to Kishore? And he wrote a book recently called Is China Winning? I don't know if you've had an opportunity
to read it. I haven't read it, but I know about the book.
And he spoke recently at the FCC at a lunchtime meeting, which I attended, in fact. And he talks about the sort of thing that you write about, Sanjeev. He talks about the balance between the United States and China and where it might be going. And its impact, of course, ultimately, very directly upon Hong Kong. So that's something you've looked at. Can you give us a sense of what you think the position is at the moment, particularly given that we had Trump re-elected, which I'm not sure it's been very well received in Hong Kong. But in any event, what do you think the position is in the round?
Here's the thing that the two candidates have in common. They both like to bash China, and they both like to bash Hong Kong. So whilst the orange man has come back to the White House, I don't foresee any real changes in the Sino-US dynamic. The Chinese have made it clear that their development, particularly the economic development, is not going to be derailed by the sanctions that are being put on, particularly on the computer chips. If anything, it highlights the inability and refusal of the US to compete on a level playing field. Why throttle these people? Why throttle Hong Kong in the process? We haven't done anything to you. And I've written about Hong Kong being at war, in a war we never started. I think what is worrying is this so-called U.S. pivot to Asia, which started under Obama. And this pivot is beginning to ramp up, not just from the U.S., but also from NATO. You're seeing some very hawkish statements coming out about Taiwan, coming out about the South China Sea generally. And the thing that I think people should watch is what I call the arc of agitation. And that stretches from northwest China, which is the Xinjiang area where the Uyghurs are, south to Hong Kong, southeast to Taiwan, and then you have China's maritime nine dash line, which is not recognized by any country. So there's plenty of fodder there to cause trouble for the wrong reasons. That being said, I do feel somewhat optimistic about the future of Asia. We've got tremendous infrastructure development. We have a rising middle class. We have a well-educated population. We're lifting people out of poverty. I mean, just China alone lifted 750 million people out of poverty, and that was recognized by the United Nations. And to some extent, China serves as a model for the ASEAN countries as well. I think where Hong Kong is concerned, we need to develop our relations with the ASEAN countries. We've kind of left it a little too late. And what we're now seeing is an integration, finally, of economics and infrastructure. So I think the long-term prognosis for Asia, ASEAN, is actually pretty good. Given that U.S. hegemony is what it is, they're not going to go quietly. So you can expect agitation, you can expect trouble, and it might even turn kinetic over Taiwan, which really does not present a national security threat to the U.S. in any shape or form. One of the things I've always suspected is that the whole idea was to create a civil war between Chinese. And the Chinese are on either side of the strait are just too smart to take the bait. I wouldn't be surprised if there's been a secret high-level deal for the reunification of Taiwan. Don't forget, Hong Kong was reunified, Macau was reunified peacefully. When Taiwan is reunified, it will mark a tremendous defeat and tremendous loss of face to Western influence in the South China Sea. So from that point of view, their window of opportunity to cause trouble is closing rapidly. There's already integration between Taiwan and the mainland in a lot of ways. But if reunification goes through, the West's ability to have any influence in the South China Sea evaporates.
So that's part of the reason for the agitation at the moment.
Yes. And none of it has any logic. There's no convincing reason why NATO should even be here.
No.
NATO was set up to deal with the Soviet Union, which doesn't exist. When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, on several occasions, Russian leadership asked, can we join NATO? And they were told no.
Yep, absolutely. So how does BRICS fit into this? Because I know you've written quite a bit about the development of BRICS. Could you perhaps just explain where you think that leads us?
BRICS is not necessarily a new development. If you look back at the 1950s, countries like India were one of the pioneers of the non-aligned movement. And the purpose of that was to break away from this very binary choice of either you support the US or you support the communists, China or the Soviet Union. So I would say that BRICS had its genesis way back when. The reason it's come to the front now is really as a result of extremist US foreign policy and extremist US monetary policy. If you look at the war in Ukraine, I think that the reason the war is important is it marked the bifurcation of the global financial system between the US dollar and the euro on one hand, and the renminbi, the ruble, and the Indian rupee on the other. And that bifurcation, I would suggest, is going to be permanent. But you've got to ask yourself, in addition to this bifurcation, there was this increased weaponization of the US dollar. And that weaponization was never more apparent than the freezing of the Russian central bank assets that were denominated in US dollars and sterling. As the Russian government pointed out, our central bank is a state organization, and the fact that you froze our assets constitutes an act of war. Now, that was a major wake-up call for many countries. Why? Because they were holding their reserves and treasuries based in US dollars. I mean, the reason we call the US dollar global reserve currency is because foreign central banks hold it for two reasons. The first is to deal with trade, and the second is to deal with any economic crisis, because the reserve currencies regard it as a currency of last resort and should be neutral. What you're seeing is the cutting off of countries from access to the US dollar, even cutting countries off from SWIFT, which is the financial messaging system, which is supposed to be neutral to countries like North Korea, Russia, Iran, Cuba. Anyone the US doesn't like gets cut out.
Are the Americans going to cut out China from SWIFT?
Here's the thing. The Chinese and the Russians have developed their own versions of SWIFT, which are compatible. So whilst the Russians have been kicked out and the Iranians have been kicked out, the messaging systems are still in place. Okay. One of the things that's really interesting about BRICS, people say it's an anti-Western organization, it's an anti-American organization, it's an anti-US dollar organization. That's not true. It's more nuanced than that. BRICS is really all about the search for alternatives in the face of hegemony that has become extreme. And it's not about creating new enemies. It's really a question of plan B. You know, if I'm cut out of the US dollar system, at least I have an alternative. And don't forget, there are countries who are interested in joining BRICS who can't get away from the US dollar system, either because they use the US dollar or because they're too tightly enmeshed in it. But at the same time, they want to consider their options. What do these options actually look like? Well, basically four. The first, bilateral currency arrangements. What does that mean? That effectively firewalls against the US dollar. I'm using your currency, you use my currency in trade. The second is increasing trade use of the renminbi, the ruble, and the rupee. Okay, so that's substitution for the US dollar. The third is central bank digital currencies, which the BRICS countries are actively looking at. That completely bypasses the US dollar. And the fourth are the increasing use of cryptocurrencies. Russia has passed a law allowing cryptocurrencies to be used in international trade. Iran is already using cryptocurrency to circumvent sanctions. Although China has banned crypto, the technology was used to build their central bank digital currency. Okay, so you're seeing the BRICS countries embracing these kind of financial alternatives. Plus, BRICS is also tied into the Belt and Road Initiative, which has a ton of infrastructural projects. So what does that mean? It means you're tying countries together infrastructurally, you're tying countries together through a unified financial system, which operates as an alternative, if needed, against the US dollar. Now, we've just finished the BRICS summit in Kazan in Russia, and there was a very interesting declaration that came out. But all of it is still pretty nascent. The new development bank, which is going to rival the IMF and the World Bank, is not yet fully off the ground. The financial systems are not yet off the ground. BRICS Bridge, which is going to be compatible with Hong Kong's Project M-Bridge. BRICS Pay, which is like a retail system like Alipay and all of that. BRICS Clearing, which is a depository clearance system. There's talk of setting up a BRICS grain exchange. So what you're seeing is a bunch of countries, very rich in commodities, rising middle class, aspirational, little bit tired and fed up of hegemony, tired and fed up of warmongering, and saying there's got to be a better way.
I can see the appeal. So we could talk about BRICS and geopolitics all day long, but let's just take it to this conclusion. When's it all going to happen? If there's going to be this split, if you were betting, when would you say? Are we talking about a year or two or 10?
We are already seeing it. People say, well, are you seeing a multipolar world? What I am seeing is the fracturing that's leading to a multipolar world. Why? Because the institutions have not yet been put in place. They're talking about it. The de-dollarization, which is being led mainly by Russia, but also by China, is taking place through the bilateral currency arrangements and all of that. Again, the central bank digital currency is another form of de-dollarization. It's important to remember that the BRICS countries are actually treading quite carefully. Some of them are still complying with American sanctions. And remember, these are US sanctions, not UN sanctions. They're still complying with it. The declaration that talked about the World Trade Organization, reform of the United Nations, and all of that isn't actually attacking those institutions. They're saying, look, we want to work with them, but the problem is they've been hijacked by the West, and in particular by the US, and it's working to our collective disadvantage.
So it's in progress, is the message.
It's a work in progress.
It's a work in progress.
I would suggest the train has left the station.
Yeah.
The US will try their very best to sabotage BRICS. They've actually come right out and said it.
Yeah.
They'll try their best to sabotage the infrastructure projects through the creation of various terrorist groups across Central Asia, because they've lost control of Eurasia under the Mackinder Doctrine. Anyone who controlled Eurasia would control the world. That was the whole point of going into Afghanistan. That was the whole point of going into Iraq. That was the whole point of attempting to encircle Iran, which was the major prize, and then break it up in order to control Eurasia. They've lost. And Russia and China are now the main geopolitical interlocutors, not just in Central Asia, but now in West Asia, formerly known as the Middle East. I get flack for saying that.
I'm bringing that back to Hong Kong. I've heard it said that if the train leaves the station as it has, and it ends up going further down the track, the main beneficiary could be Hong Kong.
Very much so. It sounds almost cliche to say that we are well positioned, but we are. And we've got the backing of China. Why? Because one country, two systems has no direct historical parallel. This is very much a showpiece project for China, underpinned by what? Underpinned by our common law legal system. Just the other day, China said, we need to keep on developing and strengthening our common law system. We're very, very unusual in that respect. And I think we will become beneficiaries, not just from ASEAN, but also from Central Asia. I had a discussion with a Hong Kong think tank in which I said, you need to look at Central Asia. You need to look at countries like Uzbekistan. You need to look at countries like Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, because Hong Kong's status as super connector actually cuts both ways. It cuts both for cooperation and it cuts for competition. And right now, cities like Riyadh are very hip. Abu Dhabi, Dubai, yes. Singapore. We are competing now for global talent. And people want to come here not just as expatriates, but they're checking out Hong Kong to see, can we live here for the long term?
Hmm.
So we're now in a fight for our lives, basically. And we've got cities that are coming up hard and fast. And if we can come out with a set of cohesive policies, a proper set of a Hong Kong identity, I think we'll do very well.
Mm. And we do have to get that identity.
We do have to get that identity. The only identity we do have is one country, two systems, and this idea that Hong Kong should be administered by patriots. The unfortunate implication of that is that if you don't have a certain ethnic origin, then you're going to be excluded by the centers of power. And I think the majority of Hong Kong people don't even understand what the term patriot really means. I mean, you can't even see China. We've got nine dragons in front of us. So what does that mean? We're operating in a vacuum. We come from a history that is freakishly unique. We're all Eurasian at heart, despite what we might look like on the surface. And so we need a social identity, something that galvanizes us, something that roots us to Hong Kong. Why? If you look at the 2019 riots, people voted with their feet. If you look at COVID, people got fed up, voted with their feet. People are now beginning to trickle back, but there's still this sense of, will I or won't I? Will I really put my roots down here? Or is Dubai a better bet? Or is Abu Dhabi or Riyadh a better bet? So we really need something that acts as the magnetic draw from Hong Kong and say, look, this is who we are. This moniker of Pearl of the Orient, Asia's world city, doesn't cut it anymore. We need something that is far more inspirational and far more aspirational.
Yes. Well, on that note, it's a big topic, isn't it? We could talk about it for weeks. Sanjeev, thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure.
If we can have you back at some time, you can expand on the whole idea of how we're going to position ourselves in the world and in Asia and integrate. So thank you so much for shining a light on it.
Thank you for inviting me, Jonathan.